Welcome to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening this week and supporting public media. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, President Trump's tweets begin our show. They made a lot of news this week, including one seized on by Florida Republicans and a second tweet with painful roots in South Florida. This morning, Twitter veiled and flagged the president's tweet that he sent out in response to violent protests in Minneapolis over the death of George Floyd. The social media giant took this action because it said the president was, in its words, glorifying violence. Floyd was a black man who died in police custody, pinned under the knee of a white police officer. President Trump tweeted the phrase in response to that, and I'm quoting here, "When the looting starts, the shooting starts." Now, that is what the white former police chief of Miami said in 1967 as a threat to civil rights protesters of that era. It's not clear if the president knows the origin of the quote.
Now, the other presidential tweet this week that echoed here in Florida was the president's demand earlier in the week that North Carolina allow full attendance at the Republican National Convention in Charlotte, scheduled in late August. Top Florida Republicans seized on the opening to invite the GOP convention to the Sunshine State here to Florida. The Republican National Committee has given North Carolina until Wednesday to respond to its health and safety plan to hold the convention in Charlotte. So this is where we begin the Florida Roundup this week, politics in Florida and the president and tweets. Would you like the Republican convention to come back to Florida? Does it matter where the convention is located for your vote in November? 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800, or on Twitter at Florida Roundup.
State Senator Joe Gruters joins us now. He's chairman of the Republican Party of Florida. Senator Gruters, thanks for being with us. Before we talk about the Republican National Convention news, first let me get your reaction to the president's tweet about the protests. He said, among other things, "When the looting starts, the shooting starts." Twitter labeled that as glorifying violence, and they concealed the tweet. Is it irresponsible for the president to encourage the shooting of Americans who break the law?
No, I think it's irresponsible that Twitter would censor the president of the United States. I think that
You can still read the tweet. You can read the tweet, but there's clarification attached to it.
What happened is a complete injustice, and I think that the whole thing is sad for the victim, and I hope that justice is served. And I know the president wants the same thing, and we want swift justice. And it's and obviously the community up there is hurting, and I hope that they will. I'm glad that the officers were immediately fired, and I hope the officer is held accountable. And it just goes to show you that there's bad apples in every organization, but I. Glad that we have law enforcement doing their jobs on a daily basis to keep the peace. And this is just a sad time in our nation's history, and hopefully we'll be able to get past this soon.
It's 305-995-1800 to join the Florida Roundup. And, Senator, as we noted, that phrase had Florida ties. The former Miami-Dade County Sheriff Walter Headley first said that some 50 years ago, in response to protests and unrest during the civil rights era. He said, if there's looting, shoot to kill. Can you acknowledge the painful roots of that kind of rhetoric?
The president has, I'm sure, did not know that kind of language was used 50 years earlier. So it's for somebody to take that out and try to connect the president to it, I think it's I don't think that's fair either. I think the president could see what we all see on TV and the burning of buildings, the complete destruction of a community, and understand that, listen, protesting is one thing, but the destruction of property and the looting should never accept it.
Isn't it the job of a president to calm the nation in a time of crisis rather than encourage more violence?
He's not encouraging violence from the standpoint that he's trying to stop.
But
the
he said,
looting.
"When the looting starts, the shooting starts."
We essentially have a community that's burning, and he's trying to put people on notice that, listen, this type of behavior is not going to be tolerated. We all feel for what the community is going for, and certainly we condemn it. And it's a but I'm glad that the president is bringing attention to it to make sure that we could try to stop this community from burning more, yeah, because that serves nobody.
Let me pivot and ask you about the other big news of the week. The Florida GOP saying they'd like to bring the Republican National Convention from North Carolina here to Florida. This came after the president tweeted frustration with the way the convention logistics are playing out in North Carolina due to coronavirus and social distancing concerns. There's been talk of it, especially perhaps coming to Jacksonville, which has a Republican mayor. How would the Florida GOP, though, get around signed contracts and commitments that have already been put in place for the North Carolina event? Where do things stand with this?
Well, listen, we gave the president of the Republican National Committee gave the governor of North Carolina notices, but it's like everything else. If you can't, we need the assurance that we could do it. Listen, the president and the RNC, they do not want to abandon North Carolina. They want to have the convention in North Carolina. They spent $10 million and has thousands of man hours logistically setting everything up and planning everything. It would be a nightmare to move it, so they want to keep it there. But at the end of the day, we have to. It's like having local cooperation. It's either we're going to have a convention or we're not. And it's the governor has to give us the assurance that we're going to be able to have our convention as planned. And if they're saying no, then that's the answer to your contracts. It's the governor that's making that decision, not us. And it's a and listen, nobody wants to move. We want to keep it there. But if they refuse to allow us to have it there, then we have to go somewhere else. And of course, Florida, the governor came out early and said that Florida would be able to host a safe, secure, and successful event, even with the crisis that we're facing, and we can make it work. And it's not going to be easy, but a lot of people know, especially if you're in the service industry, restaurants, hotels, other areas, this would be a huge, economic booster shot that our state desperately needs, because you're thinking about 30 to 50,000 people for 1 or 2 weeks. It's a massive impact on in an economy. And yes, well, and not only Jacksonville, listen, you got to have local cooperation. So Jacksonville or Miami would be at the top of the list, because you have Mayor Curry, the former GOP chairman. He was the chairman the last time we had a convention in Florida in 2012.
Right.
He's very familiar with it. But then you have Mayor Jimenez, who's already indicated his desire to potentially host it down in Miami. And, of course, you have Orlando, Tampa. Tampa, the mayor came out and said they didn't want it. So that would probably cross them off the list. But at the end of the day, it's who wants to see the economic benefit? And again, this is only going to happen if the North Carolina governor refuses to allow us to have the convention.
If things don't work out there. Let me just jump in and say we're speaking with State Senator Joe Gruters. It's 305-995-1800 to join us. Tweets to @FloridaRoundup. I want to read you a quick tweet here from a listener named James. He said, "It's a bad idea for this to come to Florida. We don't need a giant convention spreading COVID-19 in our state." What about those health concerns should it come to Florida?
Listen, I think the governor's done a great job with his safe, secured, measured approach. I think that the smarter heads can prevail. We could certainly go and host this and make sure that it's safe for all the attendees and all the people working around the event itself. This is an economic booster. We're trying to get America back to work, and we're trying to get people that have been furloughed or unemployed back in the workforce. People people want to work. People want to go back. And this economic shot to the arm would be massive for Florida. So this crisis is both a health crisis and an economic one. We're obviously opening up Florida, and we haven't seen the numbers re-spike like everybody keeps on saying that was supposed to happen. And I think it shows you the governor's leadership, both heading into this crisis and into the shutdown and coming out of it.
And certainly we have benefited from a data-driven approach here in Florida. And you're right, we haven't seen the overwhelming of hospitals, which is wonderful news for the state. Let me ask you, though, related to that. There is recent polling that shows seniors in Florida, which are a key voting bloc for both parties, have started to drift away from their solid support of the president over his handling of the coronavirus pandemic. Now, as chair of the Florida GOP, how concerned are you about those new numbers?
Listen, if you believe the polls, Hillary Clinton would have been the president a couple years ago. This president has the love of the people of Florida. He's a resident of Florida. He's been here many times. And our campaign is absolutely crushing it out there. You know, we've just legit, since the shutdown, we've made over 7 million calls. The Florida Democrat Party boosted. They made 400-something thousand calls in the month of April. We are absolutely dominating. We have 150 staffers plus the on the ground. And listen, I think all you have to do is look what happens when the president goes anywhere. He is well-loved by everybody. And I think the people that want to go out and get back to work and who are employed before, it's this president who's gone to bat over and over again from the failed trade policies of the past to other regulatory-type deals, that this president will get America back to work. And if you want to see a resurgence to where we were before and even better, Donald Trump is the only real choice. And I think that people will understand that, and I think that they'll vote for him overwhelmingly, and we'll win Florida big.
Well, thank you for your time and joining the Florida Roundup. He's State Senator Joe Gruters, chairman of the Republican Party of Florida. Thanks, Senator.
Mark Caputo is with us now. He covers the 2020 presidential campaign and Florida politics for Politico. Mark, welcome back to the program. Let's talk about this possibility, as long shot as it may be, for the RNC to come to Florida for its 2020 presidential nominating campaign and convention. Your reporting indicates that the president may have gotten the idea from a Florida congressman. Tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, Trump has kind of a new favorite Florida congressman. DeSantis used to be one of them. DeSantis is now the governor, and the congressman who replaced DeSantis is Michael Waltz. And Waltz had called the president in April when the president had complained in the Washington Examiner that he felt Charlotte and North Carolina's governor were kind of giving too much of the runaround, and he wanted more clarity on having a full convention. Waltz saw that and said, well, hey, let me call the president and kind of invite him to Florida and just extend the invitation. About a month later, that is right before what was supposed to be the SpaceX rocket launch on Wednesday. On Sunday, the president took Waltz's call. They discussed the rocket launch that was pending. And also Waltz brought it up and said, hey, Mr. President, if you can't get Charlotte or North Carolina to go along with the convention you want to have there, you know, Florida's open for business. And the president seemed to like that idea. And then the next morning, bam, this string of tweets hit where the president expressed his concerns more forcefully and publicly. Now, Waltz, I think, grew up in or near Jacksonville, mentioned kind of a homeboy, a homebody, that kind of a hometown guy, and he'd like to see it in Jacksonville. That's what they discussed. Apparently, they also discussed Orlando, which bookends Waltz's district in northeast Florida. But Jacksonville probably seems like the more rational, just geographically and politically speaking, choice for a Republican National Convention to happen, because Jacksonville has a Republican mayor. It's a more Republican county. And it also borders Georgia and shares a media market with southern Georgia, and Georgia is another battleground state. So it's probably kind of like a two-for-one type venue if it were to happen. That's a big if.
It is a big if. And, of course, the president has some convention space and hotel space that he owns in Florida. It can't help but at least be thought of in this conversation in Doral and suburban Miami, and then, of course, in Palm Beach County. The Doral property is one that would host conventions, but it could not handle the size of the Republican National Convention, could it?
It couldn't, and I think this is your question is probably a good one that kind of underscores the lunacy and sloppiness of the national media sometimes. One of the reasons I think the press gets bashed for being too anti-Trump is reporters take to Twitter and start making conspiracy theory conjectures, and the issue of, like, Trump Doral, or maybe even Mar-a-Lago, or I think he has a golf club up in Jupiter in North Palm Beach County. People started speculating about that. That I mean, it's ridiculous, you know, as far as the convention space issue, which you rightfully point out. And then it turns out South Florida wasn't even discussed. Then on top of that, what I mentioned earlier, you know, Jacksonville's a Republican-run county, a Republican-run city. Palm Beach County isn't. Broward County isn't. Miami-Dade County isn't. And South Florida has more coronavirus shutdown rules and more coronavirus cases. And the as a result, you know, they're not part of the discussion, except for in the minds of some of these reporters who decide to go off half-cocked and justify the criticisms of critics who are usually wrong.
Yeah, underlying all this, of course, is the pandemic and the response in North Carolina and then the response in Florida and, of course, local responses to the pandemic and some of these hot spots. You know, the president has demanded, essentially, North Carolina allow full attendance to the RNC if it is to be held in Charlotte. Could any Florida community make that promise today?
That's a great question. I don't know if anyone can, and I do wonder if there is going to be a full attendance rally anyway. I mean, this is an opportunity to maybe test a way to have a bunch of people in the space and not get anyone sick, but it does seem like quite a risk.
Yeah. How important is Florida to the reelection campaign for the president? You just heard from the Republican Party of Florida Chairman Joe Gruters and his assessment of how the president and his campaign process has been going here during the coronavirus pandemic and, of course, the economic recession that has hit because of a consequence. Mark, you still with us? Mark, I think you broke up a little bit. What about Florida's kind of position in this as it relates to the president's response to COVID-19 and the economy?
Yeah, well, you're coming in and out, so if I cut out, I'm sorry. Am I still there, by the way?
You are still. Go ahead, Mark. Just a couple minutes.
All right, good to know. I caught most of that, but just so you understand, so Florida, usually when campaigns are run, they break down the nation in regions, and Florida is part of the Southeast region. The Trump campaign is the first in my memory where they actually have a Southeast region, and then Florida is considered a separate region. Thanks to the vagaries of the Electoral College, the state of Florida is essentially a must-win with 29 Electoral College votes for a Republican. Now, that wasn't true in 2016, but in the words of Joe Gruters, who you just had on, the Republican Party of Florida chairman, if they lose Florida, they're going to lose the election. And the president has dumped a disproportionate amount of time, attention, and love here. And he's even changed his residence. He is now officially a Palm Beach County resident.
And also embracing the boat culture in Florida and elsewhere with these Trump flotillas. Campaigning has been interrupted, no traditional big rallies, but describe these Trump flotillas for us.
Right. Well, I wrote about that today in Politico. Is the, you know, with the weather being as beautiful as it was, but no rallies happening, Trump supporters started to organically take to the water and have these big Trump-tillas, flotillas, boat parades. And it's been a way for them to exercise their support and show their support for the president, socially distance at the same time, and get out on the water.
Yeah.
And it spread throughout Florida and then up to the Carolinas over the Memorial Day weekend, all the way out to California, and even almost in between. Arizona, of all places, actually has kind of a large boating culture.
Yeah.
And
Mark,
we're going to probably see it start to spread across the Great Lakes. Yeah,
we got to leave it there. Mark Caputo, national campaign reporter for Politico, covering Florida in the 2020 election. More to come.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for being with us this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Thanks for listening. It is 305-995-1800. We began the program talking about a couple of presidential tweets that echoed in Florida. One talking about the possibility of the Republican National Convention moving out of Charlotte, and another that used a phrase that was used by a Miami police chief in 1967 regarding civil rights protesters, and the president using that phrase early this morning, just after midnight, in relation to the violent protests that we've seen in Minneapolis against police violence. Lucerella in Cocoa Beach is up first on line two. Go ahead. You are on the radio.
Hi. I was listening earlier, and I believe it was Senator Joe that was discussing that it was not proper to censor the president on Twitter. And I just want to be clear and want to understand, presenting factual information once someone discloses not factual information is not censorship.
Right. Yeah? So there were two incidents this week with the president and Twitter. One was a tweet that he discussed what he alleged to be fraud when it comes to mail-in balloting, that Twitter put a fact check on it. And then the other was just after midnight Eastern time tonight, when he used this phrase that Twitter then masked, saying that it included
that it glorified violence.
Yeah. Glorified violence, that's it, yeah.
Correct, yeah. And he's doing both. He is presenting untruth, so we have to fact check to be sure what we're hearing and what we're seeing is true. And then, in addition, the leader of our free world here should probably be offering a more considerate, compassionate, and a creative way of answering the depth of pain and loss that our nation is feeling right now, both in the aggressive nature of that arrest and with the pandemic that we're facing.
Yeah. I appreciate you adding your voice to this conversation here on the Florida Roundup from Cocoa Beach. Thank you very much.
Lots of tweets coming into the Florida Roundup. Brandon tweets the show. The Trump tweets encouraged violence with no words of empathy, no effort to communicate with the mayors in St. Paul and Minneapolis to help calm the situation, no leadership. We're focusing on this, by the way, even though we're a Florida-based show, because as Tom said, that phrase, the president tweeted out, when the looting starts, the shooting starts, that has Florida ties. And, of course, another presidential tweet about the Republican National Convention has brought Florida into the mix. There's new polling as well that shows Florida seniors in particular are softening their support for the president over his handling of the coronavirus pandemic. So we're talking about all of that right now on the show. It's 305-995-1800. Let's go to Armando. He's in Parkland, Florida. Armando, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi. Hi, thank you all for taking my call. First, I want to say respectfully to the senator that I believe he's 100% wrong. I do not think Trump is the right person to lead this country to get out of this pandemic. I should tell you that I am a Republican. Came to this country when I was 4 years old from Cuba, and my family has always leaned Republican. But after watching the way Trump has managed his presidency, I think he is the worst choice right now, simply because everything the man does, he does thinking of how it's going to benefit him, not the country. There's many examples I could get into, but I won't. The only one that I'll use is the pandemic. He clearly ignored even people in his own administration. And as a result, we are where we are today.
Well, Armando, let me ask you as a follow-up. You say you lean Republican. You come from the South Florida Cuban community. Typically, Republican voters, who will get your vote for president this November?
Anybody but Trump. That's what I'm doing. And the reason for that is, and this lady that was on the call before me said it very gently, that the president is saying untruth. No, sorry. Let's call it what it is. The president lies all the time, and he put us in this situation. Not that he put us in the pandemic, but he didn't react to it simply because he was looking out for his interest in being reelected. That's clear in my mind and clear in many minds. So he's the wrong person to do this, because I'm thinking of the Republican Party. If he wins again, he will completely destroy the Republican Party. And I'm still a Republican, but I'm not a Trump Republican, because Trump really wants to be a dictator.
And well, Armando, I hear you. We're not taking a position on your comments, but we want to give voice to your comments. So I want to thank you for calling and letting us know where your head is at with this. So thanks, Armando. That's Armando Collin from Parkland. And he did talk quite a bit, as we have been today, about the pandemic. It's affecting all aspects of life, Tom, which brings us to another big story that we want to focus on right now here on the Florida Roundup. Florida's 12 state universities came out this week with a plan to bring back students and faculty this fall, and campus life is going to look very different. The schools will determine all of their own procedures like masks and testing and social distancing. And so depending on where kids go to school, Tom, they could be looking at a very different picture wherever they are in the state.
Definitely, right? And universities and schools play such an important role in just kind of setting policy, of setting expectations in communities about going back to school. So how can students and employees safely return to campus in the fall? If you're a student or a parent or you work at a university, will you return? 305-995-1800. Your phone call is coming up on this. 305-995-1800 or at Florida Roundup. Marshall Kreiser is with us now. He's the chancellor of the State University System of Florida. Chancellor, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for your time today.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here.
So will Florida universities hold on-campus classes in the fall?
Our expectation is that we will do that. Our Board of Governors yesterday approved a blueprint that we have developed that will guide the 12 universities in planning for that process. But I would add also that one of our goals in this is to best understand where our students want to receive their education and to have the flexibility so that if someone chooses to come back to campus, we have a plan for them, but also if an individual chooses to continue online, that we have the flexibility to cover that as well.
So will universities then be required to offer the same class both online as well as in person?
Well, most of our universities today already offer a mix of both online education as well as face-to-face education in most of their classes. And even in a case where a particular university might not have an online course, one of the nice things about our system is that students can also take that course from another university. So my belief is somewhere in the system, we're going to have that flexibility to be able to serve that student.
Will universities have the ability to cancel on-campus classes if they feel that is in the public health interest of staff, faculty, and students?
What we're going to do is work very closely with the Department of Health. In fact, we have been doing that and developing the blueprint, and we intend to continue doing it so that we have a process for screening and testing and identifying where we may have instances of the COVID virus. And we will be prepared to react to that. But we also anticipate having the ability to respond when an individual has either contracted the virus or has been potentially exposed to it. But we'll have plans to keep them safe as well as to be able to keep our other students as well as our faculty and staff safe.
Chancellor, what are the health metrics that will be used to determine if and how a campus will reopen? What's the guidance from the Board of Governors to the 12 institutions as they put together their own particular plans in terms of what should they be paying attention to in relation to the pandemic in making these decisions?
Generally, we're following the guidance of the Department of Health and following some of the same metrics they do. We will be monitoring to determine whether we see an increase in COVID-type symptoms on our campuses, which would lead to individuals being tested. We'll also be looking at the percent of positive results and tracking that very closely, not only on the individual campuses, but across the system.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, the Department of Health releases data on a county-wide level as well as a state level, but not on a college campus level. Are you going to essentially require the campuses to have some kind of campus-wide testing protocol in place in order to open in the fall?
We will have testing protocols, but it is also important to understand, we use the phrase shared responsibility. Our campuses are each part of a local community, a county, to be specific. And in that case, it's going to be important not only for students, faculty, and employees, but also visitors to our campuses, volunteers in our campuses, as well as local health and county government leaders to all be involved in understanding how we best protect the community as a whole. We don't see ourselves as being separate from the community in which the campuses are located, but we see ourselves as being an integral partner in that.
Yeah.
And we're going to be working very closely with all of the key stakeholders to make sure that we're focused on the issue of health.
You have put together this blueprint from the Board of Governors for the 12 institutions to use as they put together their own particular plans, but there's not a specific policy regarding masks or hand sanitizers or even testing. Why not have uniform rules for the universities regarding those kinds of protocols?
I would describe it this way, is that we're sitting here in the end of May. We know that things have changed since COVID began in our state. We expect that things are going to continue to change. And so in our guidelines, what we expect to have is protocols for everything from testing, tracing, which is often used to understand who else might have been exposed to the virus, as well as personal protective gear, cleanliness standards, and our protocols will continue to evolve. One is first the universities bring their plans together, but then even as we approach August and then September, one of the reasons for not putting down a specific rule now is because we want to have the agility to be able to continue to evolve those rules as we get closer. But I would expect that you're going to see more continuity, more consistency as we approach fall opening.
Chancellor, hold the line here. I want to bring in Bill from Tallahassee, who has some personal experience on campus. Bill, I'm tight on time, but I wanted to squeeze your comment in. Go ahead.
I teach in Tallahassee, as you said, and I'm apprehensive about going in to teach again, but I will do what is asked of me. I feel like I'm teaching effectively online, but that interpersonal interaction is probably more effective.
Bill, I appreciate that. Chancellor, what would you like to say to Bill, a professor in Tallahassee, about his apprehension about going back to the classroom?
Yeah, I think the first thing I would say is that our entire approach to COVID has been safety first. And we recognize that in a campus community, we've got lots of different individuals, and we recognize that we're going to have folks who may have pre-existing medical conditions that make them high risk. They may be faculty, they may be students, they may be staff. And we understand also that some people may have folks at home.
Yeah.
Our hope is that we're going to have the flexibility by the time these plans come together, and not hope, I think really our belief is that we're going to have the flexibility in these plans that we can continue for our faculty to teach classes safely, that our students are going to be able to take their courses safely, and we're really going to be relying on this idea of everybody working together to make a safe campus environment.
Chancellor, sorry for the interruption. We're just tight on time here, sir. I appreciate your moments with us here. Chancellor Marshall Kreiser, the chancellor of the university system in the state of Florida. You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
Andrew Atterbury reports for Politico and covers education in Florida. Andrew, thanks for being with us. You know, we heard from that faculty member at UF expressing some apprehension about going back to campus. Faculty members have been pleading that their voices be heard in this whole conversation. What are their concerns here?
Absolutely. Thanks. And thanks for having me. So yesterday, some faculty with the United Faculty of Florida, they spoke at the Board of Governors meeting, and it seems like, for the most part, they agree with the blueprint that they set out. They like the testing policies, but some of the things that came up, the fact that every school does have the decision to make their own plan, it leaves them wanting more input, and also leaves them with some questions, and they want to make sure that they get everything they want in reopening.
Yeah, faculty have called for more federal aid to colleges as well, as you've reported. At the same time, there are budget cuts and higher COVID expenses. Enrollment could be affected by this pandemic. What are some of the financial strains and pressures that could be changing the campus experience over time?
Are you sure? You're right. In universities, they're planning for different scenarios at this point, whether it's 10% enrollment loss up to even more than that. And but so far, though, everyone's been too hesitant to forecast what their enrollment for the fall might look like. But there was some positive news over the summer where tons of universities, almost all of them, the ones I talked to, they said that their summer school enrollment has actually improved. Mm. Now, of course, it's all online, and it could be students just trying to knock out some courses before the fall. But there's at least some good news there for enrollment. So I think is the biggest question right now is how is enrollment going to look in the fall? And I think that's why you hear the Board of Governors say that they want to have some flexibility here, because they want to give schools an ability to make the best plan to help their students. And it seems like the biggest focus I heard yesterday was on, yes, we want to offer in-person classes when we can, but the biggest deal is we also want to have those same courses available online, you know, on distance learning for students who aren't comfortable. That way everybody can still enroll, but they can, you know, have a different way of doing it.
Let's get one quick call in for you, Andrew. Let's get one quick call in for you quickly. It's Heather in Maitland. Heather, go ahead.
Hi. I have a daughter. Our first is actually heading off to UF in the fall. That is the plan. But I haven't heard anything with regard to dormitories. And
how will those be? Right, sure. And I hate to cut you off, Heather, but we're about to hit a break. So, Andrew, as a mom out there calling in, you know, what do you say to someone sending their kid off to a college dorm in all of this?
Yeah, all right, that's a big issue. And what the early plans that are taking shape now, they're talking about, you know, single person dorms, not rooming anybody with someone else, spreading everyone out the best they can. But of course, when you get thousands of people on one campus, that's going to be one of the biggest issues. And that's why for the students I hear, one of their biggest issues is how do you work extracurriculars? How do you play volleyball? How do you go outside and do sports and things like that? So there's
you'll keep reporting on it. We're going to have to keep reading you in Politico to learn the latest. He's Andrew Atterbury, covering education in Florida for Politico. Andrew, we'll continue to follow this story as campuses reopen. Thanks so much for being with us. In a moment, a judge rules on Amendment 4 in Florida. That's next on the Florida Roundup.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
On Sunday, a federal judge ruled that Florida residents with a prior felony conviction cannot be banned from voting if they still owe court fines and fees that they're unable to pay. It's an important ruling, one that was highly anticipated, and it said that key portions of the state's felon voting law were unconstitutional, and it could pave the way for hundreds of thousands of Floridians to register to vote in November's presidential election. However, Governor Ron DeSantis said on Tuesday this week that he would appeal this decision. So what does that mean for all those waiting to register?
That's the question. 305-995-1800 here on the Florida Roundup as we welcome Danny Rivero. He's been covering the case for WLRN in Miami. Jimmy Midyet is with us. He's a former ACLU attorney and is a candidate for Duval County Clerk of Courts. Gentlemen, good to have you both. We'll begin with you, Danny. We also need to note we invited the director of Florida's Division of Elections to join us. Her spokesman declined. They're not commenting on active litigation. But following on this ruling, where do the voters in this bucket stand when it comes to their voting rights this fall? Will they be able to vote or not?
So a short answer, and I suppose a correction to the Division of Elections, no appeal has been filed at this point. So this is actually at this point not active litigation until they actually file something like that. So that does go to the answer to the question, where does this leave voters? Where this leaves voters is what the judge said is right now the law of the land. If you owe money in fines connected to a felony conviction and you want to register to vote and you genuinely can't afford that money, there is now a process in the state of Florida where you can go and you can go get your voting rights back. Another small thing to add is Judge Hinkle, who ruled on this case, he said that only fines and restitution are applicable. There's this whole other category of you know, money owed called fees, or sometimes they call them court costs. And the judge ruled in that he said that those are actually taxes because those go to fund things like just keeping the doors of the courts open. So he said no matter how much money you owe in costs or fines, that doesn't matter. That can't stop you from voting no matter what you owe, if you can't afford it, if you can't afford it, because that's a tax.
Jimmy Mediet, let's bring you into the discussion. This amendment was passed by 64% of Floridians a few years ago. The will of the voters was to restore the right to vote for people in the state with a prior felony conviction. Immediately, Republican lawmakers put a new series of conditions on this, and the governor and the legislature say they'll continue to appeal. Can you explain why this is such an issue when it comes to the battle over the state's electoral votes, particularly this November in the presidential election?
Well, I would suspect, and thank you for having me, Melissa, I suspect the big battle is over the fact that Florida is the swingingest of swing states, and folks in the legislature and the governor's office are concerned about how the state will go for the president. So this has been something that we've seen developing, as you say, ever since the voters overwhelmingly approved Amendment 4 in 2018. And immediately the next legislative session was gaveled into session, and they went to the legislators went to work on setting up roadblocks to impede the will of the voters and to deny the franchise to some 800,000 or so of the returning citizens who were affected by Amendment 4.
And let's track the progress of this as well, Danny. This will go to an appellate court, right, up in Atlanta. It could potentially go to the Supreme Court. Is that right?
That's right. Whenever an appeal is filed, and the governor did indicate that an appeal will be filed, that will go to an appeals court in Atlanta. Worth mentioning that, you know, a preliminary part of this case already went up to that appeals court, and the appeals court sided against the state of Florida. So Florida, when it goes into this appeal, is already going with considerable baggage from what that appeals court already ruled. And Judge Hinkle, in his order he issued over the weekend, he pointed again and again to the ruling that the appeals court already made on this case that was against the state of Florida. But yes, it will go there, we can imagine, once it's filed. And then, you know, there's been whispers for a long time that a case of this kind is really ready for the Supreme Court to review. You know, who knows if they'll take it if it does go that way, but that definitely is a potential.
We're talking about Amendment 4 in Florida, the effort to restore the right to vote to felons in the state. Federal judge over the weekend ruled in a case with the state that much of the implementation language that the legislature put in place after voters approved Amendment 4 was unconstitutional. 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800. Danny, in that ruling that came down over the weekend, Judge Hinkle in Tallahassee also required some new paperwork on the part of county election supervisors. Tell us about what that is, and is that in use right now as we speak, less than a week later?
Right. So one of the things that Hinkle's order really tried to put to rest is just confusion that a lot of people have about, are they eligible to vote? Are they not eligible to vote? When Amendment 4 first went into effect, the assumption a lot of people had is that everyone, you know, for the most part, could go register to vote. And then the legislature passed this with these stipulations about money. And then what happened is people tried to figure out if they owed money. And in a lot of cases, the records keeping in the state is just so spotty. And there's some records that are held by county governments and some that aren't. And it became impossible for a lot of people to figure it out. So the judge ordered that every county supervisor of elections office needs to have a very simple form that he wrote up available, and that will be sent to the state. And basically that says, how much do I owe? And you can check a box that says, I believe I cannot pay the money that I owe. And if the state responds within 21 days with very specific information, you can take it from there. If they don't respond within 21 days, you will automatically be given the right to vote. If they can't find the paperwork to tell you what you owe, the judge's you know, form that he came up with will grant you the right to vote. Now, I was checking it as of yesterday. The only county that I found that actually had this on their website is Miami-Dade County. Broward County Supervisor of Elections told me that it was not a settled issue, and it was not the law, which is not really correct. I did hear from them this morning, and they said that they've received guidance from the state, the Department of State from the state of Florida, and they will soon go ahead and move and put that documentation on their website. I checked it this morning, but it still wasn't there. But that should be coming soon.
And you're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Jimmy Midyett, the organization you used to be affiliated with, the ACLU, fought this out in the state of Florida. They said asking people with a prior felony conviction to pay fines and fees was a modern-day poll tax. We began the hour talking about presidential tweets, one of them that was fact-checked on Twitter that had to do with mail-in ballots and allegations of voter fraud. The big political divide over this is whether you see the bigger problem around the franchise in this state as one of voter fraud or one of voter suppression. And so as people go to the polls this fall, this whole argument in Florida is about expanding the ballot to as many of the state's residents as possible. That has been a difficult political argument in this state and in this country, hasn't it?
It has. But the promise of our democracy is that everyone should be able to participate. And that's what has happened successively throughout our history as a people. There have been moves to expand the franchise. And that's what Amendment 4 represents. That's what the push for more absentee or mail-in balloting is about. The fact of the matter is that the president himself voted by mail ballot in the recent Republican presidential preference primary. So I think, you know, you have to take some of the rhetoric and separate it from what the impact is and what is happening in the real world. Amendment 4 is about expanding the franchise, as I say, and that's exactly what we've seen. The folks who are most interested in suppressing the vote or, you know, having fewer voters able to participate are typically those who fear the outcome of that vote.
Jimmy, it's Tom. What will a felon experience if they try to register to vote today?
Well, here's the thing, and I don't, and apparently some of the supervisors of elections haven't gotten the memo, but Judge Hinkle's ruling is final until it's appealed. And even after it's appealed, assuming that happens, whether or not the 11th Circuit will issue a stay on that ruling is an open question. I think that because Judge Hinkle was able to sort of insulate his ruling from that potentiality from the 11th Circuit, that means that a felon, a returning citizen today, has the right to register and vote. And that's the message that I'm trying to send to everyone that I talk to. At this point, in this moment, on May 29th, folks should register and they should plan to vote.
Jimmy Midyett, former ACLU attorney. Jimmy, thank you for your time today. We appreciate it.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
And Danny Rivero, reporter at WLRN. You know, a lot of focus, Danny, has been on registering to vote for November, rightfully so, but August has a lot of primary elections, especially for local elections, and that means folks have to register by late June, July timeframe in order to vote for that August primary. Danny, thanks for sharing your reporting with us as well.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to everyone who called and tweeted the Florida Roundup today. It's produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Denise Royal are the producers.
Jason Zabka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming, WLRN's Director of Radio Operations, and our Technical Director is Peter Meritz. We get engineering help each and every week from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres. Our theme music is provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Have a great weekend. We'll be back next Friday at noon.